Early holiday savings have arrived at Tanger Outlets. Discover the best gifts from your favorite brands, perfect for everyone on your list. And stack your savings with up to 70% off, plus an extra 15 to 25% off only during Tanger Style. Save at Polo Ralph Lauren, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, Skechers, J.Crew Factory, and more. Hurry in. These early holiday deals last through November 24th. Tanger Outlets. More savings, more cheer.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for 100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get 100 off a cocktail maker when you spend $400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's bartesian.com/cocktail.
Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dress, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Dress listeners, we are back with part two of our eye-opening, pun intended, episode this week on the global history of wearing eyeliner. Journalist Zara Hankir joins us to continue discussing her book, Eyeliner, A Cultural History, which I'm saying it again out loud, is one of my new, very all-time favorite fashion history books of all time. It is a globe-trotting endeavor that situates eyeliner in a 3,000-year history, as it's not only makeup, but also medicine, ritual, and relates to spiritual practices.
And in part one, Zara chatted with us about the cosmetic practices of the ancient Egyptians and the prevalence of eyeliner, which was used by men, women, and even children. And we also broke down how historically eyeliner has never been gendered exclusively feminine by many cultures, including the Wahdabi peoples of the Fulani ethnic group in Africa, and also more or less the entirety of the 22 nations of the Arab world. So today we pick back up with Zara in the United States as she sheds a light on the cultural meaning of eyeliner and makeup in Mexican-American Chola culture.
We will also head to India, Japan, speak about drag culture. I mean, there is so much more to unpack here. So without further ado, Zara, welcome back to Dressed. Zara, thank you very much for leading me directly into my next question. Could you give us a little bit of an overview of what the Chola aesthetic is and what it means in a cultural context? Because you quote an anthropologist in your book. Her name is Norma Mendoza Denton.
Yes, I love that buddy.
And she says, if you want to know what a Chola is, just look for the eyeliner.
I have to say, people often ask me what my favorite chapter is, and this really is one of my favorites because of the women I met from the Chicana Chola community in California. And just the profound respect that I have for the way that they celebrate their identities. And it's something that I, as an Arab woman myself, can relate to and really felt the depths of. The Chola aesthetic is a very distinct style, right? And it is associated specifically with the Mexican-American Chicana subculture. So it originated actually in California in the 60s and 70s, although you would have seen the ripple effects elsewhere as well. And the roots of that are actually in a form of cultural pride, but I would go beyond that and say it was a form of cultural resistance as well. Because when the Mexican community came to the United States, of course, they faced a lot of discrimination and racism. And one of the forms of discrimination was this idea that they had to assimilate to look more like Anglo-Americans, right? To minimize their brownness and to minimize any aesthetic or cultural practices that they brought along with them from Mexico. But the response to that was actually, no, we have a distinct style. And we are going to celebrate that style. And that style, it evolved over the years. It was formerly known as the Pachuca style. Then it became the Chola aesthetic, which is what I'm going to talk about a lot, explore in the book. And that is essentially a combination of sort of fashion, makeup, and I would even add attitude. And this idea of Prile, it's a combination of those three things to form this very distinct look. And the look involves this like dark, thinly drawn, highly arched eyebrows, right? Like you see those eyebrows, you know what eyebrows I'm talking about. Sometimes an eyeliner or a brow pencil will be used to enhance that look of the eyebrows with the arch. Then of course you have the heavy eyeliner, right? With the exaggerated wing and that very defined tip to the liner.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very specific shape and you know it when you see it.
It really is. And then you would have the very defined lip liner. And actually, sometimes eyeliner was used to line the lips as well. But it's that idea of having like the distinctly dark lip liner against a lighter lip color. And then you would have the contouring. But I would say actually, really, it's the lip liner and the eyeliner. And then with the clothing, you have the big hoop earrings and you have the big hair. And you've got like the thick chain necklaces, like the nameplate necklaces. And then you might have the bandanas, you might have the hand bracelets, and then the clothing, you know, you would have like oversized flannel, like plaid shirts, you'd have the tank tops, the crop tops, the high-waisted like baggy jeans, the Dickies, the Ben Davis, and then you would have the tattoos and the nail art. And yeah, so it was like a combination of that, like this fierce, distinct look that really speaks to this cultural pride, this idea of we are rejecting what you are forcing upon us. We reject your racism, your discrimination. We are celebrating our culture and we are expressing that in a way that really defies any cultural norms that were expected of them. So to me, I actually ended up going to lowrider shows in Los Angeles, which was a lot of fun because they often come together and they dress up this way. And it's not just them, right? It's other communities of color, right? It's like the Black community and other communities, brown and Black communities coming together to celebrate their culture, right? And to see that eyeliner is part of that. And it's also eyeliner also speaks to stories of coming of age. I think that's important. I touched on that yet. Is that like when you wear it, it's like you're entering this like new phase or a new period of life, even though in some cultures, actually eyeliner is applied to the eyes of newborn babies, but it can also signal as a protective practice, yes. But it can also signal if a person is single or taken or whatever, but particularly in the Chola community, it is also associated with coming of age. So often people will start wearing it then as well. So just being able to immerse myself in that culture to speak, I have an incredible protagonist, main character, whose name is Winona in that chapter, who is a very prominent Chola known by everyone in the community and wears eyeliner as a symbol of defiance, but also a celebration of the legacy of her ancestors, especially her mother, who faced a lot of discrimination in the US and died by suicide when she was younger, when Winona was quite young, actually. So to me, to have that trust from the community, to be able to explore it, to be able to identify with it, to feel that solidarity was one of the most profound experiences from my book. I often actually say that eyeliner is the story of like mothers and daughters, grandmothers and granddaughters. It is this practice of cultural continuation, passing along a profound ritualistic performance of not only beautifying oneself, but connecting with others, connecting with people not only within your culture, but other cultures, other communities across the centuries. So I often say that Nefertiti is like the original beauty influencer, but you don't have to look that far. You know, I look at my grandmother, both of my grandmothers, right? I look at my mother, who, when she started wearing eyeliner, when I started coming of age, observing my mother putting eyeliner on, I was living, or my parents had moved to the UK during the Lebanese Civil War, right? And as a young girl, I observed my mother putting her eyeliner on in the morning, and I could see that it was a ritualistic process. I could see that she was connecting to something much deeper than simply this object she was holding in her hand. Because she was connecting to her culture. She was connecting to the Arab world. She was connecting to her mother at a time of great instability in her homeland. There was a war back home. And it was like she was traversing the oceans simply by lining her eyes. And in fact, many years later, I feel that I'm doing the same. I am in Brooklyn. when I put on my eyeliner, I feel like I'm adorning my face with my culture. And I feel like I'm connecting to my mother, who is actually in Lebanon now during the war. And this is, to me, it's a source of comfort. There's never a day when I don't wear my eyeliner. I'm constantly wearing it. And to me, it's like a protective blanket. And that's how fascinating eyeliner is that it tells different stories for different people. To me, if I don't wear eyeliner, I feel something is missing because I'm not in that day connecting with my Arabness in the same way. I'm also part Egyptian too. So it's like this beautiful celebration of all of the different identities that are contained within me. I really say that to say that it is this cultural continuation that is expressed through this one object. And to me, it's actually not simply a cosmetic object. It's a cultural artifact. That is how I look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure you're going to have a ton of thoughts on what I'm about to say next, because in the last chapter of your book, that chapter deals with influencer culture, beauty influencer culture, which in recent years has seen a lot of Caucasian white influencers being called out for lifting, borrowing, aka stealing, some of these very established beauty practices of both Black and brown women and not crediting them, and also not understanding the cultural significance of these beauty practices that they're borrowing. So can we talk about this a little bit?
I do touch on that. I think it's fair to touch on. I think it's important because it starts with Nefertiti, really, when there was this obsession with Nefertiti 100 years ago in the 1920s when her bust was revealed to the world. You had white Western women who were essentially emulating her look. And to do that, they were lining their eyes and they were styling their hair in a particular way, or they were wearing the big collar necklaces, but they were also advised by beauty magazines not to darken their skin. They were advised literally to cherry pick certain aspects of brown and black beauty. And we see the same thing happening today, right? Now, I do want to say, however, I do not think it is cultural appropriation to wear eyeliner. I think it is important to understand the origins, and it is important also to wear it sensitively. There are certain looks or trends that are problematic. One of these, which I mentioned in the influencer chapter, is called fox eye, which is where the eye is lined to give it this sort of slanted look. And this is essentially emulating a look that many Asian women are born with and that they were mocked for growing up. And then suddenly styling yourself this way or wearing makeup in this way is quote unquote trendy. Now, this is where I say it's problematic to wear eyeliner in this way, right? The other thing is we have to recognize that there are still structural imbalances in the beauty industry, despite the fact that we might see more brown and black faces. It's important to consider whose faces we're seeing, how dark skinned the person is. Also, are there people of color who are in senior roles in the beauty industry actually calling the shots, making the decisions? So these are important things to consider. I do touch on some of this in the book. I think it's important to touch on it because there's actually no way to really separate the story of eyeliner from this fetishizing of brown and black beauty, starting with Nefertiti, but also not fully seeing the humanity and understanding the cultural contributions from the same communities because of that cherry picking. So that's essentially why I touched on that in the influencer chapter.
Well, also too, I think that this cherry picking, like you just said, in a contemporary context, also applies to gender and contemporary notions of eyeliner being gendered as feminine. And this is something that you debunk again and again in the last half of your book, which details eyeliner practices in India, Japan, the UK, the US. And a lot of times what you're speaking about, the use of eyeliner is in the context of performance spaces. And a lot of these performance spaces historically blur gender lines. So could you tell us a little bit more about the use of kajal in India in general, and then maybe even more specifically, its use in Indian traditional dance, this one particular form of traditional dance, which is called Kathakali? I have to say that the role of cosmetics in dance is very interesting to me. This is a personal interest, because one of my best friends is a professor of dance at Tulane in New Orleans, and we have traveled all over the world attending dance performances together. So this role of makeup in dance is both a personal and also a professional interest. But for any of our listeners who might not know, what is Kathakali?
I really appreciate you picking up on that performance element too, because it was almost accidental. I didn't really think, oh, I'm going to have a book filled with performances around the world.
I know we keep bringing this up. I can't stop. But again, here's that through line. There is a connection between perhaps the drag queen and the Kathakali dancer. And when I read your book, I literally wrote notes about this cross-cultural similarities are in the realm of performance. And we're also going to talk about geisha culture here soon, too.
Yeah. Well, I think really important here to say that, you know, eyeliner is such an important tool for transformation, to transform into maybe a version of yourself that otherwise you wouldn't be able to attain or see.
Or envision yourself in.
Yeah, absolutely. What I love about drag queens is this idea that you can really experiment with your gender identity, and there is that fluidity, and that eyeliner really allows a man to explore in that way, right? To pick up these tools that are traditionally associated with women, even though they really shouldn't be, as I said.
Historically, we have already established this.
Yeah, we've established that. Yeah. And to really line the eyes and to allow them to explore this difference in a way that is also performative, because they become other character, and they can really immerse themselves in that experience on stage. And that was really exciting for me to see with a couple of New Yorkers who I profiled in the chapter, but also to see the commonalities between that community and performance elsewhere, right? Now, the Kathakali community in India, really, it's the eye dance, right? So the eyes are really important in telling a story, and not just eyes and eye movements, but also hand movements together. They're coordinated to tell a story. Now, because the eyes are so important in Indian culture, and specifically in this traditional dance, the lining of the eyes and the decoration of the eyes takes on this other meaning as well, right? So you can be a specific character depending on how your eyes are lined, like how extravagant the lining is, the colors that are used, and also the way that the story unravels, right? The importance is also so that people in the audience can really view you from afar, right? Because often these performances would be by candlelight, very dim lighting. So the expressions of the face and the eyes are so important that you need to have the eyes of the audience drawn to the eyes of the performer. And to do that, you would give that extravagant line. And that's actually part of the reason why drag queens have extravagantly lined eyes as well.
I love the fact in your book that you point out in Kathakali, and I would also argue in Indonesian dance traditions, that the more extravagant the eyeliner, the more evil the character.
Yes, I love that thing. We love that. And oh my gosh, like I say, it's like architecture on the forehead, like the way that it goes from the eye area up to the forehead to the temples. It's so fascinating. And the other thing is, like, just speaking to the idea of having a very distinctly lined eye for the audience, that actually, you could also see that in the 1920s on the silver screen, where it was black and white, and the actors would have to wear eyeliner so that their eyes would pop on screen, right? So it's similarity, that commonality. Now, with Kathakali, it's a very spiritual form of dance, right? And it is really transfixing. And it is the way that the stories are told and the importance of the eyes speak to this idea of the third eye, right? And it's like an ethereal experience where you are connecting with something very spiritual, and the eye is playing that important role. And that is why I actually chose this particular form of dance to really tell the story of Kajal in India. And I went to Kerala to tell the story, right? And again, it's this idea of zeroing in on a cultural practice. There are commonalities, but there's also a very unique element to this cultural practice that you do see in other forms of traditional Indian dance as well. And I like that you mentioned the Indonesian dance too. So you see this in other performances and performance arts in Asia, really the importance of the eye, protecting the eye and telling a story through the eye too. One of the people that I spoke to who's a Kathakali dancer, and I think important to say that for many years, Kathakali dancers were men who would make themselves up to look like women, but more and more we're seeing women as Kathakali dancers. So one of the women who I spoke to was saying it's like a portal to another world, and you will be transported to that world through my eyes. And without the framing of the eyes, that would not be possible.
Us ladies have all been there. feeling a smidge off the days before your cycle is something that we have all experienced at one point or another. For some of us, it's occasional. For others, it's a monthly battle.
Which is why Happy Mammoth has created Estro Control, a capsule containing science-backed herbal extracts that help support hormonal health, especially in women who suffer from PMS.
The way Estro Control eases PMS is quite interesting. The ingredients help support the liver, and that's where our hormones get processed, especially estrogen. So when the estrogen isn't processed well in the liver, this can potentially trigger PMS.
Estro Control is made specifically for women who are premenopausal, so it's perfect for women that haven't entered menopause yet. In fact, it's amazing for perimenopause, when hormones start to fluctuate and PMS can hit hard.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for $100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get $100 off a cocktail maker when you spend $400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's bartesian.com/cocktail.
Okay, if I can, I would like to transport us to Japan. I'm hoping that we could talk about Japanese geisha culture, as I referenced earlier, and specifically this very distinctive tradition of wearing red eyeliner. Could you tell us a little bit more about this and the wearing of mabari?
Of course. Mabari is an interesting word and hadn't really been present in sort of English texts on the culture of the geisha. I worked very closely with a Japanese research assistant, and I'm so indebted to her and other research assistants I worked with. But mabari is the practice of lining the eyes, right? And it could be in black and in red, but specifically red would be to protect against the evil spirits. And I love that because, again, you have distinct cultures around the world, in the ancient worlds of Egypt, Persia, Japan, etc. And you're still seeing that common thread of protecting against an evil spirit, even though those cultures and time periods are very distinct. So that was something that I really felt when I was doing the research. Now, specifically looking at geisha culture, what is so interesting about it, especially when it comes to eyeliner, is that the eyeliner itself is minimalist. The lines are actually not super heavy, but they're very deliberate. They're very intentional. Again, speaking to this idea of protecting it against the evil spirit by using the color red, but also the lines are different and symbolic depending on whether you are a maiko, which is an apprentice geisha, or an actual geisha, right? So traditional geisha makeup doesn't use eyeliner in the Western sense. It's not bold. It's not along the lashes. It's like a subtle defining of the eye to enhance their shape. Again, delicacy is one of the components of how maiko and geisha line their eyes, right? So it's just a touch of black or red around the eyes, mostly around the outer corners. And this speaks to this idea of like youth and beauty and passion. But again, it is also for protection, right? Of course, geisha makeup is known also for the white heavy foundation, which is very distinct. So the eyeliner also helps to create that contrast, right? It emphasizes that red and black accent, right? And that makes the eyes appear to be, again, from a distance, much more vibrant and expressive. And then you also have this, the highly defined eyebrows, right? And the arch shape of the eyebrows. Older, more experienced geisha tend to use softer and less defined eye makeup styles with a focus more on subtlety and grace, right? But those nuances to me were really incredible. And I was also able to profile a millennial geisha who really just spoke to me of what her life was like as a geisha and how important eyeliner was to her and how she wore it when she was in costume or out of costume. And she just had this very sort of casual, like blasé approach to her job in a way that, like, I don't know, maybe a tech worker in San Francisco might not. And it's like, this is my job. Like, I gotta make the money. It's just very, it's very interesting to me to be able to delve in that world. And then also using Tokyo, because I profiled the geisha in Kyoto, but I used Tokyo also as a base to tell the story of how vibrant eyeliner use is across the younger generations in Japan. And the sort of the story of makeup in Japan is in times of great social disarray or grieving, makeup tends to be more muted than in other time periods. And that also to me was really interesting, right? Whereas like makeup is reflecting the national mood. So to be able, where again, each culture, sometimes people will tell me, oh, some components of the book felt repetitive. And I do understand that, but I also feel that each culture is actually very unique when it comes to the milieu of the makeup and how makeup and eyeliner are used.
Long before I actually became a fashion historian, I had been reading about and became a little bit obsessed with kimono culture and all of the symbolism that's embedded into it, especially in terms of color. And one of my favorite things that I learned before I became a fashion historian, and this is probably one of those points that sparked interest, was when I learned about the practice of Iki and Edo period Japan. That's IKI. My mind was blown. So basically, and this is very general, it was this practice that was flaunting sumptuary laws at the time, because throughout fashion history, there have been all these mandates on who could wear what in terms of luxury that have been passed to govern what class can wear what. But one of my favorites of these sumptuary laws was in Japan, and a law was passed about who could wear the most elaborate embroidered clothing and certain colors. So everybody who was in the merchant class who had become wealthy was like, oh, you're not going to allow us to wear that. We're just going to wear it on the inside now. So they reversed it. And they started wearing very muted, dull colors on the outside of their kimono. And on the inside was where all the super amazing bright silk and embroidery was. So that luxury, it's the original quiet luxury, essentially. It would only show when you moved, or maybe you did an intentional movement. And I really love that. I think there's also a little bit of a similarity in terms of geisha traditions too, in terms of the makeup, because it's only that little pop of red. It's still very subtle. And I just love the fact that there is this entire language of color in how geisha dress for the changing seasons also. And to me, I'm still very smitten with it. Maybe it's because it's one of my first entrees into these bigger, broader meanings of fashion. But it's a supreme example of how fashion can be used as this highly sophisticated form of communication.
Absolutely. And I think important also to note the colors, the importance of the colors red, white, and black, which are traditional Japanese colors that are often used in Japanese art, right? So you have the red is often associated with like vitality and passion and, of course, protection. The white is more like purity and simplicity, and the black carries different meanings. But often the combination of these colors is actually quite common and symbolizes something of a balance, right? So I think that's also important to note, because the geisha costume or aesthetic incorporates those three colors.
I hope, and I would love to tell you that I really enjoyed the part of your book where you talk about how male nobles in Japanese court culture historically sometimes imitated women's makeup. And also fast forward to how sometimes Japanese warriors during the Heian period wore makeup to combat.
Yes.
Why were they doing this?
I think it was a form of strength. It wasn't viewed as effeminate in any way. It was viewed as like a form of getting into, I mean, Vikings also wore eyeliner when they went into battle. So it's not entirely unheard of. And I think, especially because it played protective properties as well. But again, if makeup has a meaning that goes beyond the aesthetic, and if it has that spiritual meaning, and if it has that protective meaning, then to me, it's not surprising at all.
You also note in the book that sometimes Japanese warriors wore makeup into battle because in case their heads got cut off, yes, you heard me right, that they would be beautiful when their heads were found.
Yes. And I think it also played a role of like intimidation, where if you're wearing the makeup, you appear to be more fearsome and you have this like psychological advantage over other warriors, your enemy on the battlefield. And again, it speaks to that ability to transform, right? Where makeup can be used to create a specific, like maybe a ferocious look or a demonic look, right? And that is the power of makeup. So I just, to me, like this idea of theater and performance and even the battlefield are connected because you have that spiritual component, you've got the protective component, and then you also have this ability to transform into something, right?
Absolutely. Okay, so here's my last question for you, or maybe second to last question for you. But we've covered this global history of men wearing eyeliner for millennia for various reasons and in various contexts, different cultural contexts. Why do you think that we're still having this conversation today in Western culture about eyeliner being a performance of gender or the use of eyeliner? And also, do you think that this is an increasingly moot point given the increased visibility of drag culture? Because the last chapter of your book, or maybe it's the second to last chapter of your book, is basically entirely devoted to drag. Where are we now in this conversation about eyeliner and gender?
It's really interesting because I had been asked by a couple of people and a couple of commenters made the comment that like by writing a book about eyeliner, this like frivolous object.
It's not frivolous. It's never frivolous. And that's one of the reasons why we have been making this show successfully for 7 years and we're having this conversation right now.
Yeah. By writing this, it's not feminist at all because it's speaking to or playing into this idea of a woman having to make up herself or like it being important for a woman to make up herself. But my book actually completely debunks that by virtue of actually firstly highlighting this issue of it not being a female preoccupation, that actually historically across the centuries, this has been an object used by men and women. And also the idea that it goes far beyond beauty, that it is a cultural artifact, that it is not solely a cosmetic that is intended to make a woman look a certain way to please the male gaze. It goes far beyond that. It speaks to identity, to history, to culture, to spirituality, to religion, to science, to it's a wide range of different factors, right? So to me, that question is just, it doesn't at all apply, I think, in this specific situation, because I think eyeliner is multifaceted and it is a cultural artifact. And as far as gender, yes, there is a blurring across gender lines, right? So again, it doesn't speak to just a woman or a man. It speaks to this idea of fluidity, that a woman and a man can wear it in different ways, or somebody who is non-binary, someone who is trans, someone. It allows people to explore and to express themselves. And that is not limited to gender.
Yeah. And it's not only contemporary ideas of beauty, it's historical. And one of the things that we love about making the show is revealing biases by way of the historical record, you know, showing up with the receipts, so to say.
Exactly. And I think I really do want to disrupt this idea of what is beautiful and the beauty standards that we have looked up to and upheld have been Eurocentric beauty standards, right? And my goal here was to say, hey, look at these different communities that have used eyeliner in different ways. People tend to look at makeup through a very Western lens. And to me, that is very limiting because you are completely neglecting all of those other histories that are revolving around this particular object. And that was my goal of the book. And I really do think I'm proud of the book in the sense that I do think I've achieved it, that I do think I definitely illustrated the power of eyeliner across communities.
Yes, it's amazing. And Zara, we have only scratched the surface in our conversation, in our two-part conversation about your incredibly beautifully researched book. I just want to say that I speed read. So usually when I'm prepping for an interview, I'll allot a day to read a book that a guest has written. And listeners, please just know, and a potential future guests and past guests, please know that Cass and I do read each and every book cover to cover when we have guests on the show. But this is one of the greatest gifts for us in being able to continue and enhance our own education in fashion history. But I spent 2 days on your book because not only is it 350 pages or so,
but also because I learned so much new information that I did not already know that I really wanted to take my time with it and make sure that it sunk in.
Yeah, thank you. I did put a lot of love and labor into it, and I appreciate so much when people recognize the research that went into it.
Thank you so much. And we didn't even get to all the communities or even the chapters that are in your book. So listeners, you are just going to have to get your hands on it to learn a ton more.
Yes, I can give a snippet of the joy chapter. Yes, there's a Bedouin man in there who says, people often ask me if I'm copying the Pirates of the Caribbean, like Johnny Depp's look. And I tell them that I'm the OG, that he copies me, which I actually love. That was a very funny quote. So the Bedouin chapter speaks to how Kahal is used in that community for multiple purposes, some of which we touched on. And then we didn't talk about the Amy Winehouse chapter, which is one of the dearest chapters to me because I love Amy Winehouse. And that speaks to how eyeliner played a transformative role in her own personal evolution of her physicality and her aesthetic, but also many other things that she was going through as well.
Yeah, I went to Jordan as a child. And when I was there, I think I was only 8, something like that. I was fascinated by all the Bedouin men and their eyeliner. I thought they were so, so beautiful.
Thank you. I mean, I'm very familiar with that culture being Arab myself, but I did learn a lot about the Bedouin community. I immersed myself in that community for several days as well.
Zahra, thank you so much for being here. And also, to be truly, perfectly honest, thank you for one of my favorite fashion history reads of this entire year. I probably read about 50 or so fashion history books a year. And my friends who recommended that we do an episode with you were spot on. This book, yes, it's about eyeliner, but it is also about all this other amazing things too. And it's about the power of self-fashioning and how eyeliner is this source, historical source of connection for a lot of people.
I love that. That really made my day. And it's a difficult day today. It really made my day. Thank you so much, April. I really appreciate it. I think we can say that it's been a weird week, but this has been a delightful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here. And thank you so much for your book. And dress listeners, you can, of course, find Eyeliner, A Cultural History, on our Dressed bookshelf at bookshop.org/shop/dressed.
Zahra, thank you so much for your amazing work and research on the subject of eyeliner. And April, this is one of those episodes where the subject seems fairly straightforward, but then has all these stories that are revealed suddenly, and it becomes incredibly complex.
Yeah, and one of the things that like really was one of my biggest surprises is how they're all interconnected, or all the same themes emerge throughout all these different cultures. And I said this again and again in the episode, but the wearing of eyeliner as a tie to one's own cultural identity, or some of these generational ties that emerge, I've never personally stopped to consider this before. So this is really fascinating for me. But I think that does it for us this week. May you consider how makeup factors into your identity next time you get dressed.
Dressed listeners, if you'd like to reach out, you know we love hearing from you, so please send us an email at hello@dressedhistory.com. Dressedhistory.com is also our website where you will find more information about our upcoming classes, tours, and anything else we have up our finely tailored sleeves.
Which in the next couple of weeks will include our listing or our posting to register for our next Dressed the School of Fashion course, which Cass and I are going to co-teach on the histories of haute couture in the 1950s. If you'd like to find visual content connected to each of our week's episodes, you can follow us on Instagram at @dressed_podcast. The content specifically connected to this week's episodes can be found at the hashtags dressed518 and dressed519.
Love Dressed but want to skip the ads? Consider subscribing to the ad-free version of the show for just $3 a month. As always, thank you all for your continued support. More Dressed coming your way soon. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for $100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get $100 off a cocktail maker when you spend $400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's BARTESIAN.com/cocktail.